Hi everybody, welcome along for Sunday morning, and we continue on with our Lamrim Chenmo studies. So let's begin by doing a short breathing meditation. Then I'll set up a visualization, we'll take refuge together and generate the mind of enlightenment. So get comfortable in the seat. Have your shoulders relaxed and your back straight, and place your hands wherever you like. And allowing the body to breathe itself. Just like you do when you go to sleep at night. The body is quite capable of looking after itself, and so it can breathe itself quite normally and naturally. And while the body continues to breathe itself, become aware of the movements that take place. Each time the breath is exhaled, and each time the breath is inhaled. Be aware that the mind is a little more focused now and the body is more relaxed. And from the state of relaxed concentration, imagine that the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, the Arahats, the Yogis, all appear in the space above you. And surrounding you are all sentient beings. At the center of the refuge field above you appears Lama Tsongkhapa. They recognize that you are leading all sentient beings in the process of taking refuge. You're guiding every living being in a safe direction. Recognizing that everybody wishes to be free from suffering, everyone wants to be happy, and no one actually is. Become the leader in this journey to bring about a sense of personal salvation and universal responsibility. Recite along with me the refuge prayer and the bodhicitta prayer. I go for refuge until I am enlightened. Through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Spirit. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So in response to this prayer, I think that now lights come up from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa and wash over you. And these lights and nectars remove every obstacle and hindrance to the wish. Having all hindrances removed, now recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. And then again, imagine lights and nectars coming from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa and washing over yourself and all sentient beings. And feel as if you and everyone else surrounding you have been established into these four immeasurable states. And now you see yourself prostrating to Lama Tsongkhapa in the refuge field. Making offerings. Laying down the faults and problems of the past. Then rejoicing in the fact that you've done so. And also in the kindness of all beings. Request that the teachers and the teachings remain in this world. And dedicate the merits of the seven limb practice towards your own goals of awakening for the benefit of others. And now we come to the practice where we let go of the very last vestiges of clinging to the merit, to our ideas about ourselves and our ideas about everything else. So this leads us into the mandala offering. So if you just recite along with me. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnaryatayami. We've released the offering and it's been accepted by Lama Tsongkhapa and he smiles at us with delight. And we look up into his eyes. And we think that we're accepted. And then an emanation leaves the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa, moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head. Facing the same direction you are, the emanation begins to descend, entering the crown of your head, going down through the skull, down through the throat, and at the level of the heart, rests. And the light begins to expand, filling your body and your mind. The light goes out through the pores of your skin and the light fills the 10 directions of space. And wherever there are beings within space, that they're touched by this light and brought to full awakening. Now there's no difference between yourself and anyone else. The sense of joy arises within you if you have established every living being in a state of full enlightenment. And then the lights begin to withdraw from the 10 directions and they re-enter your heart. feel yourself embodied. I'm sitting on the seat. And you realize that this is just taking place in the form of imagination. But even so, you've placed upon your mind stream a potential to bring this about fully. Now, potential on your mind stream to awaken yourself and help everybody else do the same. Okay, let's have a look and see. So somehow or other I've missed the slide, but this is what I've been relying upon for the information. So I've looked at also Lama, Geshe Tashi Searing's material as well, is really what we're basing this on. This other materials to sort of help us. Here's the actual Lama Chenmo, Lama Song Kappas. And we're going through like 29 questions today, so quite a few questions. I think there's about 14 of them, between 12 and 14, are like a review. And then the rest is this new material. Because we've started a new section now of the Lam Rim Chenmo. We're really sort of moving into the practices of serenity, or also known as calm abiding. So our first question will be, in the stages of path shared with persons of small capacity, what should motivate us? Any ideas, anyone? So I'm not going to just switch over yet because it doesn't take much to answer this. Any ideas? What's the motivation here?
Try and understand the teachings of the lower scope of the Lam Rim Chenmo.
That's right. So we need to try and understand this. And so what's the motivation of a person of small capacity, anyone?
To avoid rebirth in the lower realms.
Good one. That's right, Chris. So avoid rebirth in the lower realms and take rebirth in the higher realms. That's right. So we need to avoid lower realm rebirth, attain a fortunate rebirth, and understand that and practice like that.
I think Metta might have had something to say too.
Okay.
I was the same as Chris.
Okay, thank you, Metta. And then we ask another question about this person of small capacity, which is in the stages of the path shared with a person of small capacity, what's the most important section? So I'm going to throw it open to you, see if anyone can just pop out with an answer. Anyone can do it.
Understanding the laws of cause and effect, like karma, that your actions will create lower rebirths, or
So there's two really important parts here, and one leads to the other. So the most important part is, just as you've said, Fran, is to observe the law of karma and the specifics related to its effects. That's the most important thing. So in this, so the two things are to take refuge and to observe the law of karma and specific effects. So now we come to a couple of questions about persons of medium capacity. So here the question is, in the stages of the path shared with a person of medium capacity, what's the most important section to encourage the determination to be free?
Putting on true sufferings, the shortcomings of psychic existence.
Yeah, that's right. So we need to reflect on the truth of suffering, and in particular, the faults of psychic existence. If we do that, we are, inspired to seek freedom, to bring about the true cessations, and then we know that we'll engage in true paths. So we have another question about these people of medium capacity. It says, in the stages of the path shared with persons of medium capacity. What shows us how to develop this determination? What are we sort of meditating
on? Bodhisattva.
Sorry?
Bodhisattva.
Not yet.
Love it.
Coming up, Meta.
Next one.
Yep, next one. That's right.
Eddie, I think it's reflection on death.
Not quite. It's part of
12 links.
Sorry?
Links? The 12 links?
Yep. Basically, it's to recognize the true origins. So this picture here is a showing of the true origins, isn't it?
Is that the true
origins? Here we've got karma, and in the middle we've got the afflictions. And these are the true origins of suffering. Next question is, what does the section on the 12 links of dependent origination teach us? Anybody recollect?
How we enter into psychic existence,
and
how we can abandon psychic existence.
That's right. How we get in and how we get out. That's right.
So it's not a revolving door. Yeah. So instead of like in prisons, the revolving door, you know, you get out of prison, you just go straight back in again within a month. It's like how to get out.
Yeah. So here it's really saying the shortcomings of psychic existence and how to abandon its origins, which is basically just what Sue said, how you get in and how you get out. Now, these 12 links can be subsumed in different ways. I mean, they can be fit into other categories. And one of the most common categories, of course, is the Four Noble Truths, because like pointed out, Sue, how you get in and how you get out. So the question is asked, of course, so how are these 12 links subsumed under the First Noble Truth? So here we're not going through the whole lot, we're just asking the First Noble Truth.
Suffering.
Any ideas?
Suffering. The links that subsume under suffering.
Say it again, please, sir.
Like Meta was just saying, it's the truth of suffering. So when you're looking at the 12 links, they can be broken into karma, delusion, and suffering. So there's the causes, the karma and the delusion, and then there's the true suffering links.
Yep. Okay, so anyone recollect what they, in terms of the links, which ones are the afflictions? Which ones are the karma and which ones are the suffering?
So starting with the afflictions, I think it's the first one regarding the formative action. And I think it's the second and third one as well. So it's the affliction, the formative action. I think it's due to ignorance is the affliction.
Okay, so then we've got ignorance, number one, right?
Yes.
First link, number one. Well, that's an affliction, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, so we've got number one. What else?
Craving and grasping.
Excellent. Okay, so what links are those?
8 and 9.
8 and 9, that's right. So we've got 1, 8, and 9. They are afflictions. Which ones are karma?
Compositional actions, number 2, and number 10, existence.
Okay, so we've got 1, 8, 9, 2, and 10. We can rule them out because we're looking here for finish right.
First, the 8th and the 9th are afflictions.
So That's how it works, right? True sufferings are number seven, are these remaining seven. The true origins are 1, 8, 9, 2, and 10. So those who could, it's a little good thing to remember this one. So you did really well here, Sue, remembering most of these. So yeah, karma is a really simple one, 2 and 10. It's like you said before, because you know, the formative actions, that's number 2. And then 10 is just the flip side of that. It's not like when it comes to be, it's just called becoming. And another simple one is like Sue, you go, okay, so we've got ignorance, craving and grasping is necessary. So 1, 8, 9, 2, and 10, there's your true origins of suffering, second noble truth. The rest is just for the, you know, I think they say a mass of suffering. So that's the rest of the links. It's pretty nice, isn't it? So concise. Mm. And I think this has come from Nagarjuna. So then, question 7 is, what are the most important sections requiring continuous study? So here's a clue. So remember, this is to do with this is all to do with persons of middling capacity or medium capacity. So what's the person trying to do if you have a middling capacity, or you know, what are the trainings shared with that person? What's their goal? Miffy?
So the goal is complete liberation from samsara altogether.
Yep, that's right.
And so the trainings would have to be shared, the three higher trainings.
Yep, that's right. So in all of that, what's the most important stuff to read over again and again?
The wisdom side, selflessness.
It's once again, it's this, how you accumulate karma and the way you take rebirth, how you come into cyclic existence. Because if you know how you come in, then you can know how to stop it.
So that's like the 12 links, for instance.
Yeah, that's right. So you can either look at that through the 12 links or the Four Noble Truths. Because both are presenting the same material. It's just they're doing it in a slightly different way. Because here, if you say, yeah, the way you accumulate karma, well, that's true origins. And then the way you take rebirth, that's a true suffering. Okay, so these are the questions were asked for those of small and middling capacity. So here we come to your favourite meta, those of great capacity. So what's the question here? It says, in the stages of the path of great capacity, what's the essential topic?
Strive for enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings.
So this is a picture of Chandrakirti, right? This one here is. There's plenty of pictures, but he often looks like that. He's got his hand out like that. Can anyone recollect the praise of Chandrakirti? At the start of his text, he said,
"It leads to great compassion."
That's right. I praise great compassion in the beginning. I praise great compassion in the middle and the end. So the emphasis here is on great compassion. And great compassion, of course, is, you know, as, what's the name? Yeah, if we read through that material, like, yeah, this is really important, the beginning and the middle and the end. So this great compassion, how is it developed in the small scope and the middle scope? Anybody like to have a go?
Reflecting on the sufferings of the lower realms for the small scope,
we reflect upon the sufferings of those in the lower realms. And how about the middle scope, Sue?
Sufferings of cyclic existence in general, how we circle for all sentient beings. Right.
So we begin with compassion for all beings in the lower realms, and then we continue with compassion for all beings. So now I come to this next interesting question, which is how do we cause our virtue to be the cause of liberation instead of cyclic existence? So it's interesting what it's saying here, isn't it? It's sort of saying virtue can be a cause for cyclic existence, but it could also be a cause for liberation. What makes the difference? Chris, any ideas?
Your underlying motivation, Eddie, whether it's virtuous or non-virtuous.
No, so here, Chris, so we're not on the non-virtuous side, we're already on the virtuous side.
Okay, so it should be supported by bodhicitta.
Okay, anyone else?
Yeah, that we've got to seal our virtue with emptiness, with the three seals of emptiness, because otherwise we just keep having really fortunate rebirth, but we just miss it and we come back to samsara.
Yeah, so we've got to, as Miffy just said, so we've got to recollect, always try to remember that whatever virtue we have generated, it always lacks the inherent existence it seems to have. So we've got to bring in, bring in the wisdom side to the method side.
And this really explains a lot for me, Eddie, because when you read about the preciousness of a human rebirth and how difficult it is to get, then you think, well, if it's that difficult, then why am I still, and I've got it, why am I still stuck in here? And it's because of missing this crucial component.
Yeah. As you pointed out before, Sue, so even though we have virtue, where links 1, 8, and 9 are in play. So we've got ignorance about how the virtue exists and how we exist as the creators of it and the goals of it. And there's a grasping to it and a clinging to our ideas about it. So that keeps us locked in.
And so, Eddie, is that why, like in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, where it says any bodhisattva that says, I'm a bodhisattva or I'm creating merit, is not a bodhisattva?
Yeah, that's right. So, a couple of more questions about. So, what we're talking about here is really integrating the method and the wisdom side. So we're talking about these true origins. We could be talking about renunciation because we're letting go of the origins. But we can only effectively let go of them if we combine the practice with the wisdom, realizing the selflessness of that phenomenon, the emptiness of it. So a couple of questions about method and wisdom. Well, the first is quite straightforward. What does it mean to integrate method and wisdom? So let's look at it from the lower scope and then we'll walk to the great scope. In terms of what are we doing when we integrate the method and wisdom of practices that are below the great scope? What are we integrating there?
Well,
For the middle scope, when we're thinking about, the lower scope, we're thinking about karma and its effects, we realise that it doesn't inherently exist, that the four composites can be changed.
Right. Isn't it at the lower scope, you don't really have any understanding of the wisdom of emptiness, or, you have that level of ignorance of how things truly exist. So is that right, or do you have it at that lower scope?
So here we talk about the practices shared with the lower scope.
Okay, shared with,
yeah. We've got practices below the great scope, and then we've got practices from the great scope onwards. And both times we've got to integrate our method and wisdom.
So Chris had a question.
Yep, Chris.
So talking about common method at the lower scope, I would envisage it would be refraining from the 10 non-virtuous actions, and then having an understanding, though, that if you do engage in that, the wisdom aspect of it is you will be then cast into the lower realms, okay, which don't inherently exist from their own side.
That's right, I don't. So in brief, right? So everything beneath the great scope, the method used there is called renunciation, a wish to definitely emerge. So we're taking that wish that is definitely set to emerge and putting it with the wisdom, because then you can emerge.
That's so I'm confused that you're calling this the method. Renunciation is the method.
Yeah, it is.
Of course it makes sense, but I was probably looking too close in.
Yeah. So on that side, from everything beneath the great scope, it's renunciation combined with wisdom of selflessness, right, or emptiness. How about the great scope? What's the method there?
Well, Meta knows this one.
Meta's already told us. It's bodhicitta, isn't it? So bodhicitta is the method there. We need to bring it together with the wisdom realizing selflessness. Yeah? So often you could say it's the combination of the two bodhicittas, conventional and ultimate. But this is the most simplest way you can do it. Whenever we set our motivation to become awakened for the benefit of others, we have to just remind yourself that I don't inherently exist. That's why it's possible to actually do it. Bodhicitta is the same way. It's a dependent arising, therefore it's empty. And the goal, Buddhahood, does not exist from its own side, as Chris just said. Everything is empty. And like Miffy said before, the three spheres of emptiness. We've got to keep reminding ourselves of that. Otherwise, as has been pointed out before, our virtue becomes a true origin. We stay within the cycle of existence, and things are pretty good for us, isn't it? Up to a point.
Which is really terrifying thought, and it makes that prayer of to not get sucked into the peace of samsara. Really pertinent, that's actually more terrifying, because it's not as obvious that it's a problem. Going into the lower realms, that's terrifying, but
yeah,
putting all that effort into virtue and still being stuck in the higher realms, that's more terrifying.
Yep, that's right. And that's what it actually says in the text, that those who realize this are just as afraid of the top realms as they are of the lower realms. So I quite like what Gessler said here, isn't it? Whenever you're setting your motivation, remember this relative mind of enlightenment is empty of inherent existence. So then we get this next question. Why is it important to integrate method and wisdom? So basically it's saying this, we're sort of going over and saying the same things, but asking the question in a different way. What's the great importance of integrating method and wisdom?
At the results of the two Buddha bodies?
That's way ahead.
Are we still on, are we on great scope or middling scope at the moment?
No, this goes right across the board here, this question. In brief, again, it's what it said before. You do not want your virtue to become a true origin. Like you said before, you know, about being terrified. You do all this good work, and then it's like getting out of your prison cell and working in the library. But you still stay in prison. No matter where you are, you're in the prison. You don't want virtue to become a true origin. So these are sort of like these preliminary questions, like a review to the new material. And so this new material begins, you know, it's called training in the last of the two perfections. So these last two perfections are, of course, the perfections of concentration and wisdom. And here it's the concentrations or karma abiding or shamatha. Metta, you...
Yeah, Andy, just before we move on, that last slide said about the relative was empty of inherent existence. The ultimate's also empty of inherent existence, isn't it?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. Everything's empty of inherent existence.
That's right. Yep.
Just wanted to clarify that.
Okay. Yep. So here we go, these last two perfections. So what I've done is I've just put one single word up because it's easy to for the slide and so forth. But I'll put each one up and say what it says, right? So the first heading is the benefits of cultivating karma abiding and insight. That's the first heading. Then the next one is showing that these two include all states of concentration. So every state of concentration can be put into either the insight or karma abiding. Third is the nature of karma abiding and insight. Fourth, why it's necessary to cultivate both. And five, how to be certain about their order. And lastly, how to train in each. So I think this is these headings here, these six headings, is like on the first page of the of the new book. We're open up going, this is what we're going to go through as we go through these two perfections, in other words. So we're now into the new section of karma abiding. And in that section, we've got this interesting question. It says, what is awareness arisen from meditation? What is awareness arisen from meditation?
Calm abiding.
One. What else?
Special insight.
Hey, good one. Two. That's right. What else? That's great.
A higher realm mind?
That's right. Good one. So, karma abiding and special insights are both higher realm minds. And they're all called awareness arisen from meditation. So as soon as you get karma abiding, you already have a higher realm mind. If you have special insight, it's based on karma abiding. So you have a higher realm mind. So when one of these takes place, like karma abiding, the other two Sorry, the other one naturally follows. So in other words, we're sort of saying here, if you have calm abiding, you definitely have a higher realm mind. But just having calm abiding does not mean to say you have special insight. But if you have special insight, you have calm abiding. And then you have a higher realm mind. And these are all called awareness arisen from meditation. Now, Fran, I can see you sort of going, oh, what does that mean?
I just can't. Yeah. So what you're saying is, if you have special insight, calm abiding will arise from it. But if you have calm abiding, special insight doesn't necessarily arise. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Words are a little bit different, Fran. So you're saying, what we're saying is, if we have special insight, necessarily its foundation is calm abiding. It's not that calm abiding arises from the special insight. Karma abiding is like the foundation for the special insight. And if we have karma abiding, we've definitely got a higher realm mind.
But you don't necessarily have special insight.
That's right. That's right. So we could have, if we've got karma abiding, we have a higher realm mind. If we have special, but not necessarily insight. If we have insight, we've definitely got karma abiding and we've got a higher realm mind.
So, Eddie, could calm abiding and a higher realm mind be in a non-Buddhist path then?
Yep, that's right.
Yep. Okay. And it's then if we put the work in to develop special insight, then it's using that higher realm mind on a Buddhist trajectory.
That's right.
Yeah, so my question was similar, Eddie, that is a higher realm mind necessarily one infused with bodhicitta?
No. Only for the Buddhists.
So what's the higher realm then a non-Buddhist is on?
The form realms. The realms of form and formlessness.
So they're free from the suffering of suffering, but still have the other sufferings in there?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, so the suffering of change and all pervasive suffering of conditionality is still present. So is this clear or sort of murky?
Oh, it's a bit confusing for me.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of confusing because we don't, why does this matter? What's the consequence or what is the import of understanding this? Because I kind of feel like there's something really important here, but I can't put my finger on it.
Okay. So let's say the person is a non-Buddhist practitioner, what they used to call them, the Hindu practitioners. So the practitioners, all the practitioners before Buddha, everyone practicing before Buddha brought about his own personal freedom. So everybody's going through the stages and developing different states of concentration, which can all be put into this thing called calm abiding. They go through the 9 stages and they actually achieve calm abiding. That's a higher realm mind. Where do they go from there? They go through the levels of the form realm and they go through those, then they go through the realms of formless. They end up in a state called the peak of samsara. So none of those states are outside cyclic existence. Everybody remains within cyclic existence.
So they're outside of the desire realm, but that's not right. Outside of cyclic outside existence. Outside the
desire realm, inside these more subtle realms, still within cyclic existence. The thing that made the Buddha so different was going up through the karma body and placing special insight. So that he didn't go through into the other levels of the form realms and so forth and just stay there. He brought the insight into the Four Noble Truths, the true origins, and that put an end to them. So it's the insight that makes the difference. In fact, if insight is not bought into it, these other higher states are called mundane states of consciousness. But they're certainly different than the mundane states of the desire realm. They're quite different because, for one, you never have anger once you've got up to the state of the karma body. Anger's, you're not going to be affected by it.
Eddie, you're saying the formless realms are special insight or just insight?
Neither. They're just realms of deep concentration.
So they have no overt afflictions, but they have no wisdom.
That's right. Because they're of much greater peace than you'd experience here in the desire realm. And the major affliction that's not present is the mind of anger. But attachment is present. And craving so is
the
present.
The form and formless realms, they are a higher realm mind then, yes, still? Or, right.
They
yes.
Are. They are.
However, they don't have karma, body, and special insight. So that's reserved for, and that's a non-Buddhist practice.
These states called the form and formless realms.
They do have karma, body.
Yeah, that's right. They're all states of, they've gone beyond karma, body. Actually, karma, body, the state of karma, body has led you to those states.
But without the wisdom, it's led you to those states within samsara, just like our virtue has led us to a perfect human rebirth within samsara because we didn't have the wisdom part. So this, the concentration leads you to a higher state, higher realm, without the overt suffering, but without the wisdom, you're still in samsara.
Yep, that's right.
But with those realms, it's also the lack of body citta, because that's sort of said to be, you know, the sort of suffering of those realms too, depending, you know, in the material I was reading in the Lam Rim Year books of, yeah, you know, I'm just confused about those realms a bit.
Yeah, okay, so when I first undertook the study, Caroline, I was confused too. In fact, it's only in the last couple of weeks of just reading something that suddenly has become really clear. Like, oh, my God, that was not said. It was not pointed out. Or if it was, I missed it completely. But I've got it now. So there's this part here that I was...
Yay!
Through, it's going to be so much easier for you. So I went, oh, my God, there it is there. But at the time, it wasn't there. Fran? Yeah.
Is there somewhere we can go back to sort of revise this, somewhere where it's written down, something easy to look at?
No. I can give you the theory that you can look at it, but it's not easy. This stuff is not easy.
We don't have a for dummies version of this, do we? No.
Karma abiding for dummies. Oh, man, wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah. Well, actually... We can make this karma binding for dummies because there's only this one section that I never got at the time, and I was just holding my head. It's just I just don't get this.
Come on, Eddie, give it up.
Well, it's coming.
But I guess
first we'll have a tea break. But let's pause here because this we'll continue with this. Let's have a pause. Get yourselves a cup of tea, go to the loo if you need to, and we'll come back in, say, 10 minutes. So some of you, if you've read the biography of the Buddha's life, now there was a scene in his life where there was a festival for farming. You know, so the farmers were out there with their ploughs tilling up the earth and so forth, and it was a big deal, like springtime, you know. And the Buddha, as this little boy, was sitting underneath a tree, just sort of watching the celebration. And while he was sitting there, he went into like a trance state, a state of trance, of deep concentration. And everything became very clear and very peaceful. Then later on, he became, you know, the prince, and then he renounced the palace life. And when he renounced the palace life, he went looking for other teachers. And the other teachers, what they introduced him to were these states that we've just been talking about, meditation on the form and formless realms. That's what you could go through, up to what they call the highest state you could achieve in it, called the peak of samsara. And these states were deep states of concentration and bliss. So body and mind felt very light, and of course no anger there, very, very few afflictions because of the power of the concentration. Nevertheless, the Buddha realized that this did not bring an end to cyclic existence. Right, so he gave them up.
But also, Eddie, you were saying that the Buddha kind of remembered then, when I was a kid.
I'm going to come to that part. It's made of three parts, right? So he got to this place, and remember here, this was, these are like the states of him, as you're familiar with him, when he became really skeletal.
An ascetic.
You know, hardly eating, these deep states of concentration. And he finally figured out, this is not doing it. So what made him change his mind was this memory of him as the child watching that festival. And he remembered, at this time here, I had this sort of pleasurable experience. And he asked himself, is this like a worldly pleasure? Was I grasping at pleasure or anything like that? And he said, no, I wasn't. So he said, perhaps this is the way. So instead of going up to all those different realms, he just went up to the first access state of the form realm. He didn't keep going like he had been and making himself a skeletal being, and it was just going nowhere, really. He just went to the first part and then applied the insights, what we now call the teachings of the Four Noble Truths. So instead of just concentration, he brought in analysis, insight, and then brought about his liberation.
So, Eddie, was that insight the Four Noble Truths, or was it more like specifically insight about selflessness?
The selflessness came out of that.
Okay.
So in the first sense, and then I taught, this is the teachings of the first turning of the wheel. So we've got a couple, three different things here. One is the original feelings that he experienced and the experience itself of going out beyond the desire realm into the first, just this level of the form realm as a child, and then stopping it. That was it. Feeling this that's just what it tells you in the Pali scriptures, the story. Then later it says, he leaves the palace, he goes in search of teachers. The teachers don't teach him about insight. They teach him about these deeper states of concentration. That's really what they know. And these are the Hindu teachers. So he goes into deeper and deeper stages. And through that whole section is him being what they call the...
The austerities.
The austerities. That's right. Right? And there's a part that comes in there. He goes, this is not doing it. This does not bring freedom. So he stops and he has something to eat. And it's when he has the porridge that the maid brings him at the river, that's when he remembers, when I was a child, I did this meditation. perhaps that's where I need to go back there and try that again and bring into it this insight that he's got into the way things are. And so that's probably what we do. Yeah. That's what he did. So, Fran?
Probably the lack of protein made him forget. I don't know. No, but look, it's so when you sort of said he abandoned them, did he just dismiss the, when he was with the other teachers, did he just dismiss that these states of concentration and bliss weren't necessary?
No, or, what he was abandoning was the idea that this could lead to liberation. Like they could not, he understood this is not liberation.
Right. Okay. So that, yes. So, but he didn't abandon it totally because he then went back to it as part of
the. Yeah. Well, it's like, so he demonstrated that again at the time of his death, right? He went up through the different stages. It says in the text, he goes up through the different realms and goes up and he goes back down again, demonstrated them all again. So this is just the story to sort of demonstrate something about these different levels of concentration, what they can provide you with, but they cannot provide freedom from psychic existence. That requires insight. So these different stages called, so if you look at the three realms, desire realm, form realm, and formless realm, all of them really, you could say, in the desire realm, there's different levels of concentration you can generate. And when you go far enough up to what they call your calm abiding, you achieve the ninth state of calm abiding, and then achieving calm abiding itself, now you have a different type of experience. So you've got all the experiences before and then after. And then after, you can have even more different experiences as you go through the different levels of form realm and the formless realms. But they're all states of concentration, and they're all within psychic existence. You say, what's the difference between the experiences of the desire realm and the form and formless realms? It's the level of bliss. The bliss is different. This is what determines whether you actually have achieved the state of calm abiding. Anyway, we'll go on and I'll give you the pages too that you can have a look at and see if you see what I see in there in terms of these states of concentration. Like I said, this stuff's not, it's not easy. And like I said, for mine, as you said, Fran, when I went and did my courses up at CI, I just had to go, I don't get this. Like, I walked out even more confused than when I went up there. All I knew was there's these different levels of concentration, form and formless realms. I don't actually know what those are, where are they, all that sort of stuff. It's just like a whole lot of words to me. And come back and go, well, I can understand, I can hear this material and go, okay, there's these nine stages you go through and this is what you do and blah, blah, blah. But as soon as it came to formless realm, it was just like, forget it.
I don't get that. Even Eddie, I just remember when you were explaining to us in Discovering Buddhism about how, because we're so used to hearing about the six realms, high realms and lower realms, and I thought that's all there was. And it kind of blew my mind that actually that's all, it's like Russian dolls, you know, that's all that's all just the desire realm. Then there's form and formless realms. And I'm like, what? You mean there's more?
Yeah.
And but even just to know there's those two taxonomies, there's the six realms of existence, but that's within the desire realm. Just getting that in my head was a revelation.
And the other thing about these realms is that they're presented in two different ways. You know, so one way is just on the level of concentrations, different levels of concentration. And that's, I think, is pretty easy to get your head around. You know that, you know, we call ourselves in the desire realm, but if you concentrate deep enough, you're going to have an experience that's not like you normally have. But when that happens, there are signs of it. There's signs of it. You go, oh, you've done this then. You're right at this level.
So is that when you're being in the desire realm, but you have concentration in a higher realm?
Well, that's what we're going to move to next.
Oh, okay.
So what is this, like I said, just levels of
concentration.
But then they also talk about rebirth into these different realms, don't they? You can be reborn in the form realm or the formless realm. And so then when you think about that, you sort of think, well, where are they?
Well, they're in your garden is the answer. Yeah, because
they're mentally constructed by us. They couldn't be anywhere else. They're not independent of us. And then so it's like Mitri said, so we could be a desire realm being, meaning we have the body of the desire realm, but the mind is of the form or formless realm because we've developed it up to that level.
Or you could actually...
When we die, it's like if you've got great familiarity with those states of consciousness while you're like a desire realm being, but had the consciousness of it, you could take rebirth there. Because it's the mind that's doing the rebirth stuff, isn't it?
And then Geshe, I just remember Geshe's Opa saying, so when you're reciting your prayers and sutras and things in the garden or in your house, to say them out loud, because the beings in the formless realm, they get to actually partake of the Dharma.
Okay, I'm going to go back now and just go through a couple of slides and then talk more about what's the most, for me, what I found the most difficult stage is the movement between being a desire realm being and a form realm being. Mm-hmm. That's what I find the hardest thing to get my head around. And I couldn't a number of years ago, but I can today. So, okay, man, there's the clue right there, which I had no idea about.
And, Eddie, is that bit also like that's the really crucial one that we as practitioners don't get sidetracked, isn't it? Because that's like a fork in the road.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it is. It's a fork in the road.
Can you describe to me a form realm being? Give us an example.
Let's see. An example.
And then an example of a formless realm being. So.
Okay, so, so we have like water. Yeah? So water is something that we can see and taste and touch. It's got form. Yeah? So that's like where we are right now, the desire realm. So if you go to the form realm, it's H2O. You can't see it, but you know it exists.
So it's the most subtle. H2O.
And then if you went to like the next level up, you just go, well, it's like space. Or it's like the sky. Like that can turn into water. But it's not water now. Is that helpful, Fran?
Yeah, then it actually has the potential to be that, but it's not necessarily
that's right.
That.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
So with movement from one to the other, is that related to, the karma? You know, just say if you have the really good fortune to be reborn in the formless realm, say, you know, and, you know, yes, you are still part of, you're still in some cyclic existence then because you haven't actually attained liberation. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. You're not liberated. You're just liberated from the desire realm. Yeah.
Yeah, so then... Would we call it a fortunate realm?
Anything? Can you? Yeah. Don't we need to come back to the perfect human rebirth to become enable us, even though it is.
Let's talk about higher realm rebirths means being reborn as a human being with the leisure and opportunity, but also in those God, those what they call the God realms of the form and formless realms, because they are higher than where we are in here, and the suffering is less while you're there because they don't have anger.
Yeah, but how do we progress from those realms to liberation?
You die.
You die. But isn't that
fair enough? You can do.
So what's the how long are you in a form realm for? You know, is it eon?
To your karma, to the karma that, you know, the efforts that you've put into in previous lives and so forth to get there and stay there. They just call it the karma. If the karma runs out, you're out of there.
But then you're back down. It's like snakes and ladders then, isn't it?
That's exactly right.
Because the issue is about the form and formless realm is that you can't develop altruism there, and that's sort of what I've read by Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe, is that that's the sort of, you know, when you look at the sufferings of the six realms and what's the suffering of the form and formless realm, it's the suffering that you don't develop altruism. So when you die, because you haven't developed altruism, it's sort of probably an unfortunate rebirth.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't call it an unfortunate rebirth, though, but it's the altruism, for instance, would stop you going there. Develop altruism, just as Lama Zopa's pointed out.
But you can go there because of your level of concentration and all where you are on the levels of the yanas of all of that thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but that's... So you can have a higher realm mind, but not an altruistic mind to be there and be there. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah,
and it's like a holiday spot you can go to for a bit of a rest.
That's right. And then you got to go home. That's right. <Yeah. laughs> Okay, let's go on, and we'll see what we can do. So the next question is how is this Yeah, so this is called awareness arisen from meditation. So it's a higher realm mind, it'll be calm abiding, and it could be special insight. If it is special insight or calm abiding, it is a higher realm mind. Okay? So the question is, how is this awareness arisen from meditation attained? So here's the clue, right in front of you. How is it attained?
Going through the nine stages?
Yeah, that's right. You go through the nine stages, and that's how it's attained. Yeah, so by progressing through the nine stages of mental abiding, that's how a awareness arisen from meditation, a higher realm mind, karma body, or special insight are attained. So as Geshe says, karma body and insight are not desire realm minds. They are minds of the higher realms. A person who wishes to achieve karma abiding must go through the nine stages of mental abiding. And once they've done that, of course, they have this higher realm mind, an awareness arisen from meditation, and karma abiding or special insight. So from the point of view of these different meditative concentrations, right, there are different stages. So there is one in the desire realm, there is four in the form realm, and four in the formless realm. So the single concentration that takes place in the desire realm is subdivided into the nine stages of the development of shamatha or karma body. So after the ninth stage, shamatha or karma body is achieved. That achievement marks the beginning point of the preparatory part of the first concentration or meditative absorption of the form realm. And so you guys, are you with me so far? So right up there on that ninth level, we have the physical and mental bliss of the state of karma abiding. And that is the preparatory stage for entering the first part of the form realm. It's as if we drew a line, if we had a blackboard or a whiteboard, and we went, okay, here's the form realm, and you go, okay, there's, and so what do you have before it? You say, well, karma abiding. So you'd have like a line, wouldn't you? There's the line. Above it is the form realm. Below it is the karma abiding. And that line there is like what they call the preparatory stage for the first stage of the form realm.
Right, so the actual line.
Yeah. And how you know that this line is there? This bliss. So you can enter the form realm now.
So that's geometric line, not
an I'm sorry?
Is that right?
Sorry? Yeah, geometric line.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, it's as if you had two rooms, right? And what the entry to the two rooms was a door. And you're right in the doorway. That open door gives you access to the next room, doesn't it? But you're not in there yet, and you're not in the other room either.
That's a great analogy.
So that's what they call, you know, the preparation, the preparatory place, or what is it called? The preparatory part of the first consciousness, the preparation to enter the next room. You're not in the next room yet, but you all you have to just go over the line. You're in. So that's what I mean by the line before, you know. It's the preparatory stage. Now, that part there is the part I never understood when it was first explained to me. Because that line right there depends, the next thing you do depends upon whether it's going to be a mundane path or a super mundane path. A path to freedom or you stay enslaved. If you go into that form realm and start going up, you stay within cyclic existence. If you decide right here is the place to start investigating the truth of suffering, it could lead you to freedom. So it's that preparatory stage. It's like all the possibilities lie, like Mithy said, it's the fork in the road.
And so that's why we need to have the momentum of renunciation, yeah, so that we take the right direction.
That's right. A renunciational body cheater, so you can take the right direction. Otherwise, we stay in. So, so here I have, you know, if you can see Gishi Sopa's book, right? This is the one on karma abiding. It's called Volume 4, Shamatha. So the bottom of page 33 and over to 34 describes the process of moving from the state of karma abiding, you know, either into the form or formless realm, or going off into insight and freedom. So when this was explained to me 20 odd years ago, I didn't, you know, was not said specifically like I'm trying to tell you. You know, you have this, it's that stage of preparation. So if you don't go into the realms, and it's the only one on the other different stages of the form realms. Once you go through, you don't get that choice later on. You keep going. There's no chance to go back and go for the freedom. You'd have to come back down. But to do that, you have to do bodhicitta. And even renunciation, recognize that, heck, I'm still within cyclic existence.
Excuse me, Eddie. We say that the anger is no longer present, like the suffering is suffering. But at that point, how do you know there's still suffering of change?
Well, you probably won't. Well, you can know this, like, because what you're going through is you sort of recognize, oh, this is this. You know, there's a recognition of how good this feels. This is also a recognition that could be better, because that's what drives you from one state to the next. We're going up to the form realm. It's going, oh, it is good, but there's better ahead. So it changes. So the change is more on the level of pleasure, pleasure in states of peace. Okay, so let's have a look at our next question then. And this is straightforward. Which is attained first, calm abiding or insight? So I'm also calling calm abiding serenity. And this is the order. It goes serenity first, then the insight. So Kintsa Rinpoche says, after you've achieved calm abiding, you can go on to achieve insight. It necessarily happens that way. The order between calm abiding and insight is fixed, where calm abiding always precedes insight. And it's not possible to achieve insight before you achieve calm abiding.
But Eddie, we'd still need to do the work and the study so that our mind is interested in achieving insight and doesn't get sidetracked. Yeah.
Most of the Lam Rim is all insight.
Yeah.
It's all practice.
But this is more talking about the realization.
Well, this is insight. If you actually want to have insight into emptiness, you're not going to get that. You'll only have it on a inferential level.
Yeah.
If you actually want to realize it, you need serenity.
You need serenity. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, even at our level, without either of these two, we could work out, understand, my God, things must be empty of inherent existence. Yeah. It's impossible for them to be inherently existent. And we can even understand dependent arising. But it's all just on the level of intellect, isn't it?
Yeah. And so then if we have serenity, then we have the big, oh, I get it.
Well, no, what happens is you can keep your mind on it. The serenity allows you to place your mind on the emptiness and become more and more familiar with it. First of all, conceptual, but then through the ability of your insight, become actual. But that's not going to happen without the serenity. You know, probably some of you have remembered the example they use of a person in a dark room looking at a picture on a wall. Yeah, and they've got a lantern. So they hold like the lantern up, but there's a wind or a breeze in the wall, so the flame flickers, so you can't see the picture very well. So to see the picture well, you definitely need the flame, that's the insight, but it needs to be steadily on the picture. So then you need to put some glass around it to protect the flame. But so now it's stable. Now you've got a stable light. So the serenity gives you the stability. And of course, the insight's the light. Which isn't always the case. So, the serenity, the answer is yes. So now there comes this interesting stuff, which I hated when I first went through this, but now, 15, 20 years later, you go, wow, this is the best stuff of it. Funny how the mind works. So here's the qualm, right? The qualm is just like a question. I love really how...
Not a qual, but a qualm.
How they put it through in the text also, we're going to offer the qualm to Lama Tsongkhapa. We're not questioning him. We're not disagreeing. We're going to offer a qualm.
Very polite. That's it's so really respectful, nice. Isn't
it? So the qualm is, are not calm abiding and insight good qualities in the mind stream of someone who has reached them through meditation? You'd have to say, well, yeah, they are. But then how is it possible for good qualities to result from those two? So in sort of English, the question is, how can all the good qualities of calm abiding and insight, how can all good qualities be the result of shamatha and insight, if shamatha and insight are themselves good qualities? That's the question. That doesn't make sense. How can all good qualities be the result of karma abiding and insight if karma abiding and insight themselves are good qualities that are achieved through meditation? In response to this, Lama Tsongkhapa replies that we first of all have to understand the terms. So you might have seen in the text, I guess the put it into a syllogism. He says, are there good qualities in the continuum of a person who has not achieved karma body and insight? You have to say, yeah. So then he says, ah, well, then it follows that those are effects of karma body and insight. Why? Because they're good qualities. And you're going to go, oh, my God, that doesn't make sense. And that's the idea. That's the qualm. Right when you go, oh, my God, what are you talking about? So in response to the qualm, and like you said, you know, we need to put forward the terms, understand the terms. Here's the answer. Concentrations which at least involve one-pointedness on a virtuous object are classified with karma abiding. Virtuous cognitions that distinguish an ultimate or conventional object are classified with insight. This is what the sutra means in stating that all the virtuous qualities of the three vehicles result from karma abiding and insight. So there's no contradiction. You understand this answer? The question was hard enough to understand. You understand the answer? If somebody said they do, could you just share what you understand?
So, Eddie, is the question kind of one of causality of going, well...
That's the other one, was, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, if karma abiding and insight are good qualities and I have good qualities, therefore I have karma abiding and insight.
That's right. That's what Geshe is saying. That's what he's saying, going, well, no.
No, no, there's something missing there. There's some order or causality that's gone askew.
Yep, that's right. So if anyone thinks they understand the answer, could they share it with us? So I'm going to take it then. If nobody's sharing, you don't understand the answer. Is that right?
Gosh, even if Sue doesn't understand the answer, then you better give it to us.
So what they're sort of saying here is that what they're calling karma abiding and insight are categories, not the actual karma abiding and actual insight. They're just categories here. Which at least involve one-pointedness. They're classified with it. They go under the category. So the actual result is about karma abiding. Yep, this is a tremendous thing. And insight, yep, it's a tremendous thing. But it doesn't mean, you know, you're saying we have to have them before we can generate good qualities. And they go, no, no, they're just categories. Everything to do to gain them is put into it and called karma abiding special insight. They're not at the actual thing, but because you're doing something leading to it, they're categorized in it.
So it is that like saying that if we have good qualities, it's because we have some form of self-reflection and being able to concentrate, and that falls into this category and might one day turn into it, into karma abiding and insight.
Yeah. That's right. So every form, you know, so we try and concentrate to develop our good qualities. It's not actually karma abiding, but it fits into the category of karma abiding. Whenever we think about emptiness through whatever way we do it, we sit and we're thinking about it, it's not actual insight, but it's categorized as insight because we are trying to gain insight into the nature of reality. That's what this is saying. And that's this answers the qualm. Yeah? Because the qualm is, you know, we're sort of thinking, wow, I can only have, you know, what he's first said is that every good every good thing I've done comes out of karma abiding and special insight. And then you can go, well, I don't have karma abiding or insight. Does this mean I've done no good? I have no good qualities at all. My good qualities only come after they get karma biting the special insight. It's sort of like saying, how can a cause be an effect? Well, it depends upon how you look at it.
So this answer, Eddie, is almost like a clarification, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. This is clarifying the qualm.
And basically saying, hey, folks, don't freak out. You still do have some virtues.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So this is what Geshe Sopa says, which would help, right? In order to clear away any potential confusion regarding this topic, Lama Tsongkhapa quotes a variety of sutras. And this detailed explanation elaborates how both shamatha and vipassana, meaning karma biting and insight, can be classified in two ways, actual and partial. In order to reach the actual or real shamatha, there are 9 stages of training and corresponding accomplishment. Each of these levels is a form of partial shamatha. Then, on the side of vipassana, there are analytical meditations that are geared toward analyzing and seeing the nature and depth of reality. These are all parts of vipassana. So all the practices can be just categorized as two, can't they? And these are the parts of the whole. If we come at it from the point of view of just the whole, then we've got a problem. That's what the qualm's about. It's saying, hang on a minute, you're saying all of the good qualities that we have come from karma biting and insight. And I'd go, I don't have karma biting and insight, therefore I don't have any good qualities. And not only that, how can karma biting and insight come out of good qualities if they are good qualities? That's the qualm, right? And you're saying the answer is, well, look, what I'm saying is just having them partially developed puts them in the category.
So it is this a similar thing like when we talk about being on the path of the bodhisattvas, yeah, and in the teachings they say the bodhisattvas this and that, and yet we're not bodhisattvas?
Yeah, that's right.
So that that's same it. Kind of.
That's right.
It's included like in there. Thing.
Yeah, we start off with just the motivation. Mm. You know? Is that motivation bodhicitta? No, but you got it's partially bodhicitta though, isn't it? Because yeah, without it, you can never have bodhicitta.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's like that.
And that's what Kenshi Rinpoche always, you know, teaches too, that no, we're not on, you know, when he's teaching entering the middle way, no, we mightn't have entered the path, but we have to kind of make it like we have entered the paths and, you know, fake it till we make it sort of idea that he emphasises.
Yeah. Yep. Let's go on. So this
Sorry, Eddie, just provide sort of hope for basic practitioners like myself, you know, so just in layman's terms, so you're doing some meditation on the three jewels or renunciation, you have a little bit of an aha moment, at least now. You're thinking, well, okay, that's a tiny droplet of karma biden with maybe combined with a tiny droplet of, you know, special insight.
Yeah.
And it helps you. Otherwise, you feel completely disconnected because, you know, the harsh reality for me is, you know, I don't think I'll be on the 9th stage of shamatha in this life, for example.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm sort of getting at, Crystal. That if you took the other one quite literally, you'd say, well, I have no good qualities then. And just give up. You know, so, well, what's the point? It's so hard to get there before I have good qualities. Nah. Yep, that's right. So here the question is, what activities are necessary to attain all good qualities of the Hinayana and the Mahayana and remove all the erroneous states? Any answers? Any ideas?
Analysis and one-pointed concentration.
Sorry, Sue, say it again.
Analysis,
yep,
and then one-pointed concentration.
Yep, that's right. So all the activities that we're doing, just as Chris said, all the activities of karma, biting, and insight provide all the good qualities of the three vehicles by removing these erroneous states. I mean, that's the point of practice, isn't it? But they're all arising in defense of us placing our mind on particular objects, focusing on them, finding the antidotes and thinking, all that stuff. Okay, now we go about some of these different bonds. The question is, how do we become free from dysfunctional tendencies? And here's the simple answer. We cultivate insight and calm abiding. And I was saying to Miffy when I read this, I read, nice people have cultivated insight and calm abiding. It actually says, once people have cultivated insight and calm abiding, they are free from the bondage of dysfunctional tendencies and from the bondage of science. So then, you know, our next question is, of course, going to be about the bondage of dysfunctional tendencies and bondage of signs. What are dysfunctional tendencies? What are signs? So first, dysfunctional tendencies.
The dysfunctional tendency sounds like those movie classifications, you know, of like occasional violence and something or other tendencies, not safe for children. So, yes, dysfunctional tendencies.
So this is like, so for us, right? So we have, at present, dysfunctional tendencies. For what, you might say? So the answer is hatred, lust, all those things. Right? All the disturbing emotions, all the karmic actions that we engage in. We have the potential to do all that. That is the dysfunctional tendency.
Such a good term.
And these potentials are sometimes referred to as the stains in our minds, and predispositions, the bondage of bad habits and so forth. Now, the bondage of signs, so you know what dysfunctions are, they know it's potential. The bondage of signs is the actual mental affliction that occurs when the potential meets the conditions that allow it to manifest. So simply put, right, as a way of demonstrating this, I have a potential in my mind to be, I have potentials, we all do, for anger and hatred, don't we? All right? That is the dysfunctional tendency. The bondage of sign is when I meet the person who I could be angry or hate, and then I am angry or hate them. So it's like it's the hatred or the anger that actually comes out once the dysfunctional tendency meets the object.
So, Eddie, this term signs, is that, could we substitute it with appearance? So from the bondage of appearances or believing appearances, is that?
Well, not so much appearances, the bit's too large here. The signs are you have dysfunctional tendencies. You demonstrate anger, that's a sign. You are an unenlightened person. You have dysfunctional tendencies.
But Eddie, the dysfunctional tendency has to meet the object though.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, without meeting the object, it's not going to be.
So sign arises from meeting the object.
The object, that's right.
So it's sort of like almost like a mirror to reflect back to you. Oh, I have that dysfunctional tendency because of what's arisen.
Yeah, the sign shows I have the tendency. So the sign is like the result, and the dysfunctional tendency is like the cause.
And when we went through the sufferings of the middle path, the eight and the six sufferings, you know, regarding everything from birth, sickness, but also around your enemies will arise, what you love gets taken away from you, seems to be inherent within this as well, Eddie, you know, because you encounter the object, which could be your enemy, and you might have been perfectly calm 5 minutes before, think you're virtuous, and then the enemy arises, and then all hell breaks loose, literally, within a short period of time.
That's right. So as all hell breaks loose, this is a sign that you have a dysfunctional tendency. That's right. Yeah. So next question. So how do we free ourselves from the bondage of signs? What is one of the ways you can free yourself from that in terms of calm abiding and special insight? Another big clue. That you just place your mind single-pointedly on a virtuous object. So like I was saying, you know, like as your example put out, Chris, you know, you meet the person, normally you would think this is the enemy. But you have looked at them and you might be thinking, this is my mother from previous lifetime now. She's afflicted by suffering. She's behaving really badly. What she really requires from me is compassion. So we place the minders on compassion rather than being an enemy and allowing anger to arise. The bondage of signs. So here's this question. What is the meaning of the bondage of signs? Well, you know, just explain it. So the answer, one of the things I gave here, again from Geshe Sopa, he says, take this example. You might not always feel hate for an enemy, but the potential for the hatred is present. These dysfunctional tendencies are like seeds. The seed will not become a sprout until certain conditions of soil, sunlight, moisture, and so on are present. These potentials are variously referred to as the stains in the mind, the dysfunctional tendencies, predispositions, or the bondage of bad habits. The bondage of signs is the mental affliction that occurs when the potential meets the conditions that enable it to manifest. The bondage of signs is the mental affliction that occurs when the potential meets the condition that enables it to manifest. So like Caroline was saying, you know, the object is the condition. You have the object condition. But so another object condition might be for us, you'll find one easy way to get angry is to not eat for a long time.
To not eat for a long time. Yeah, and then you get hangry.
That's right.
So
you're short-tempered.
Is this bondage of signs then almost like talking about a latency, and that we're not aware of, say, latent anger or frustration until it becomes obvious bondage when it arises?
Yeah. So the bondage of the sign is the actual manifestation of the affliction.
And is that because that creates karma?
Well, I think it's quite obvious, isn't it? It's like, well, you know, it does create karma, of course, but just the fact that somebody's really angry, that's a sign. But this person doesn't have control over their mind. It means, in other words, they have a dysfunction going on. The mind is dysfunctional. So we've got the effect, the bondage of signs, pointing back to the dysfunctional tendencies. Okay. These are sort of more scientific Dharma words, aren't they, to describe things that ordinarily happen to us every day, ordinary occurrences.
Carolyn's got something.
Yep, Caroline.
So, Eddie, is that, you know, in Tantra, there's the, you know, they talk about the practice of with signs and without signs. Yeah. So is this the same meaning or usage of the word signs as is used in Tantra?
No.
I didn't. Good. I didn't think so. Otherwise, I was completely confused.
Yeah. The signs there, Caroline, are signs of inherent existence. So here, that, like this one here, is like that's already done. like that, the tantric one is more subtle. Mm. Because here, like the body of the signs, you're actually angry there. Mm. And it's like you've got to take a couple of steps back and go, well, what's causing that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dysfunctional tendency. And what's the dysfunctional tendency?
Mm.
To see everything as if it inherently existed. It has the signs of inherent existence. And I grasp at them. And now, you know, they're manifest as the bondage of signs.
Yeah. But in Tantra, the signs, the meditation on signs, that is that's not bondage. That's meditation based independent arising signs.
Yeah, but at the same time, those dependent arising phenomena have the signs of inherent existence.
Yeah.
So the bottom of the sign is basically the gross manifestation of the mental affliction.
So, Carolyn, and that's why you have to have meditation with signs and meditation without signs.
Yeah.
in Tantra, so that you don't have just the grasping at the inherent existence. You have dependent arising and wisdom realizing emptiness together. Sorry, Eddie.
What are the benefits of calm abiding and insight? Okay, benefits are both simply the mind is freed from the two types of obstacle. Calm abiding and special insight are the antidotes and the source of cyclic existence, and they contain all the qualities of the three vehicles. So what do you think the two types of obstacle are?
Functional tendencies.
That's one dysfunctional tendencies, and the other is?
Bondage assigned.
Excellent, Susan. That's right. There's the two types of obstacle. That's right.
I'm sure there's a T-shirt in this somewhere.
Okay, then there's this other question.
I missed the first one. What was it? I didn't hear properly.
Dysfunctional tendencies.
Two types of obstacle. And I asked, what are the two types of obstacle, Caroline? And Sue said the two types of obstacle were the bondage of dysfunctional tendencies and the bondage of signs.
Right.
And that's correct. So, next question.
Sorry, Eddie, is that also the... could be categorized as the two types of afflictions and then the cognitive?
No, not yet.
No,
that's going too far again. The cognitive really have to do with inherent existence and subject-object duality. So no, not yet. The inherent's much simpler, Chris. It's just the manifestation of the affliction and the cause of it. Question, what does it mean to say that if it is included within calm abiding and insight, it is not necessarily calm abiding or insight? Oh, my God, another one of these things. So we know the answer to this. It's just sometimes when these questions get asked, it's like, oh, God. Give me something that is included within calm abiding, but it's not calm abiding.
Unpointed focusness on loving kindness.
Yep, excellent. There's one. So now give me something that's included within insight, but it's not insight.
Analysis of the eye.
Yep, analysis of the eye, analysis of four noble truths. Any type of analysis would fit into here. This is what they're sort of getting at, right? So you have any type of concentration that's mundane, that's not going to be calm abiding. It's actually calm abiding super mundane, isn't it? And then you get the concentrations that are super mundane, they're not insight, but they are concentration. So next question is, what is fully qualified calm abiding? So here what we've got to do is just find the definition of it. And this is one of them. So there's a number of different ways of putting up the definition, depending upon what text the teacher has been sharing with you, what material you've been reading, and so forth. But basically, it's this one. This will do. So it's a concentration which is imbued with physical and mental bliss of pliancy. This is really what makes it calm abiding. It's got to be imbued with physical and mental bliss. The next one is with which you can place your mind on your object of focus in whatever way you please. All the states of concentrations, of meditative stabilizations that are without physical and mental bliss of pliancy, they're just concentrations. Once you get this level here, it's different. It's calm abiding. Now it's a higher state of consciousness. It's a super mundane awareness. It's all those different terms we've been going through. But without it, it's mundane. And it's a similar type of thing we ask, what is fully qualified insight? Again, it has to have this physical and mental bliss of pliancy. But here you can see the difference. It has arisen through the strength of analyzing the object of focus from within calm abiding. Because we know calm abiding, we need calm abiding first. It's the foundation for the insight.
So that's that order. The question about is it always in this order?
Bliss of pliancy is different than the physical bliss of mental pliancy of just calm abiding. So in other words, we've got calm abiding and it has this physical and mental bliss of pliancy. We have developed the insight, and it also has a form of physical and mental bliss of pliancy. And so these two types of come together. But one is the foundation of the other.
That's really interesting, because I've never heard it spelled out like that, that fully qualified insight also has physical and mental bliss of pliancy.
I guess that comes from the process of actually achieving calm abiding, isn't it? You actually don't lose that when you then go on to do the insight, which is good to know.
Yeah. Well, what does happen with it? It gets shaken a little bit, Caroline, when you first bring in the insight. But then over time it settles down.
Oh, that's right, yes. Mm.
Eddie, can I ask you a question?
Yep, sure.
What does, when you say the physical and mental bliss of pliancy, can you tell me just exactly what that means? Is it to be able to turn your mind to any object? Or I don't understand that.
You can turn your mind onto any object and keep it there for longer than 3 hours. But while it's there, this physical and mental bliss of pliancy are there also.
What is that?
Well,
bliss, pleasure.
Great pleasure. It's pleasure, but it's actually felt by you, so you actually know. And it's like the top of your head gets quite like really warm and like cotton wool. So it's a physical experience.
All right.
Yeah, and it's like I said, it's not like it's bliss here is a higher state of pleasure. So it's not just the pleasures. That's why I give it the name blissful.
And the pliancy is also to do with being energized, being flexible.
Yeah. Yeah. The body doesn't get tired anymore at this level. All right. The body's very, very, seems very fit and light inside. The energy is very loose. So I remember one time when we Kinsa Rinpoche, so he was in his 70s then, and we'd come back from a sand mandala. We're going down to the river to put the sand in the river. And he was walking, taking us down there. And, man, we were like running to catch up with him. All of us younger people, 15 years younger than him. And he's just going, whoom. And I was looking at that. That's one of the signs of calm abiding. If the body is really light.
Mm. Okay. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Are calm abiding and special insight differentiated by object? So is this clear to you? What it's saying is that are there some objects that we just put calm abiding on but not insight? Are there other objects that we just put insight on but not calm abiding? That's how we differentiate them. And this is the question. Are calm abiding and special insight, fully qualified, differentiated by their objects? The answer is no. You can put karma binding on any type of virtuous object, and you can analyze any type of virtuous object. And finally, so tell us why they're not differentiated, right? She says, well, because there is karma binding that knows emptiness, and there is insight which does not know emptiness. Meaning you can put karma binding on emptiness and you could put the insight into emptiness on any other object.
That is a very complex answer.
Yeah, it's like covering, it doesn't look so easy, does it? So it's fully qualified karma binding and fully qualified insight are not differentiated by their objects because each take both ultimates and conventionalities as objects of meditation. For instance, you could have special insight on emptiness. You could put insight on all mothers by all sentient beings, my mother. That's an analysis, isn't it? You're analyzing. You're getting insight. You could get insight into emptiness and then place karma biting on it. But you could also put karma biting on the fact that I know all sentient beings have been my mother. Right? So they're not differentiated. Anyway, we've come to the end. That's 29 questions.
That's the fortnightly workout.
I tell you, when I finish these, sometimes the Miffy's work through them, we go through it again, I go, you know, it's taken me quite a few days to get this together. It just looks like it's over like that. And then for us, it takes, what, 2 hours to go through too, doesn't it? And it seems like, wow.
Jeanette had a question.
Okay, Jeanette.
Oh, yeah. My mind's boggled. Yeah. I was just wondering, when you said that to develop karma binding, you've got to do all this preparatory work. You get to the ninth level. Yeah. Does that mean that you have to be studying Tantra as well?
No, it doesn't. No, this can be developed without Tantra. In fact, you only have to be a Buddhist. To get karma biting.
All right, okay.
But karma biting and insight are included in Tantra.
Yeah, well, it's like I said before, wasn't it? All the good qualities of the Mahayana are within karma biting and insight. So that would take all the Tantra stuff as well. So we've gone through 29 questions. We have all their answers.
And in which book of that was that you were just reading from on a number of Geshe Sopas, the volume?
Volume four.
Yeah. Good.
So this is the staff coming up. So the Labrum Chedmo, volume 3, we're going from page 18 to 21. From Geshe's teachings, we're into week 5, pages 1 to 10, or what we've been calling our teaching 17. And in Geshe Sopa's book, it's pages 16 to 26, Steps on the Path. This is a new volume, volume 4. Okie dokie. So let's dedicate. So I think that we exist in name only, and all the practices we've been doing are no more than conceptual designations. The goal we're seeking for the sake of others also is a dependent arising. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may we quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore, such that as long as space endures and as long as sentient beings exist, may we continue to remain to drive away their sorrows.